me say at the outset that Music as Medicine by Daniel Levitin, subtitled How We Can Harness Music's Therapeutic Power, or even its American title, which is I Heard There Was a Secret Chord, is not for sissies, of which I number myself one. It's a well-praised scientific tome written by a neuroscientist and a musician with expertise in all genres of music. In any event, I approached this feeling a little out of my depth, but found the first chapter so absorbing I was a quick convert. Only academics will read everything, but I read enough to know what I've always known. Music is food for the soul. It feeds the psyche, calms one in the most awful situations, and now I know it heals too. By music, he means rhythm and sound, from singing, humming, and lullabies to drumming, from Janis Joplin to Bach and Beethoven, Chick Corea and Mahler, and shows that many cultures throughout the world have used this for healing. He doesn't prescribe what to listen to, but says that variety is the key. He also quotes how music helps one cope. For instance, a Georgian mountaineer was known to sing in life-threatening situations. Then he says, does music fit into the workplace? Infuriatingly, by his own admission, he says, it depends. He makes so much use of research to prove his thesis that music heals and disproves others. Do you remember when we all thought that playing Mozart to our pregnant wombs or young children made them smarter? Wrong. As he says, that woefully inadequate study raised more questions than it answered. There are interesting anecdotes on musical memory. How in 1960 in Berlin, Ella Fitzgerald forgot the words to Mack the Knife, but because the rhythm was etched in her memory, she made up new words in tune and rhythm to get back to the right ones. But the most important thing is how he shows how music can be used to treat a number of problems, from Parkinson's and Alzheimer's to trauma, stroke, mental health, pain, and depression. He quotes a study that proves that older adults who play an instrument for 30 minutes a week showed robust increases in gray matter and significant improvements in auditory memory. Anyone need a music teacher? He has talked to many musicians, from Sting to Kent Nagano, and perhaps it is Paul McCartney who sums it up best. For many years, I have wondered why a bunch of frequencies organized into a piece of music has the ability, even without the words, to make the listener cry and become emotional. Although I know this happens to me and many people, I have often wondered how this can be. He concludes that Levitin offers some fascinating insights into this. Diva by Daisy Goodwin appealed to me on so many levels. The subject, Maria Callas, whose voice, despite its steeliness, I've always loved. The way it is written, which is, like La Divina herself, quite divine. The delicious, gossipy style, which tells you so much about Maria that you feel that you are in Maxime's with her. With Madame Callas herself, with Franco Zeffirelli, with the Windsors, Noel Coward, Marlene Dietrich, they're all there. Goodwin makes you feel Maria's pain from the opening paragraphs, because her life was never easy. But when she dresses for the most public performance of her life, the night that Onassis married Jackie, you get how the deeply hurt Maria was and how her feigned indifference got her through the night. It masked her loss and her hurt. Maria nailed it, if Daisy is to be believed, and I believe Daisy. Somehow she's created something so tangible, something so precious, something that is heartbreaking, despite the obsessions, emotional dependence, and insecurities, which made the diva really high maintenance. While the novel mainly covers just some of the 9 years Maria and Onassis were a couple, it doesn't go far enough in telling you what they did except cruise the Mediterranean, discussing why Ari was not giving a diamond bracelet to someone else, sleeping with another woman, or why Maria couldn't accept operatic roles, and then, of course, why he couldn't be bothered to come to performances. But there's enough to get the gist. More than the measure of what sounds like a controlling, horrible, and devious man, one who wanted to abort the baby Maria eventually lost. And there's enough to set the scene of her relationship with her mother, Stormy, her sister, Jealousy, and the only constant in her life, her beloved maid, Bruna. At the outset, I Googled Maria, and I watched performances and clips, and noted consistencies in the story, so I thought, wow, Daisy has done her research. Then I got to the physical intimacy between Maria and Onassis and thought, Daisy had to have been there, in the lifeboat, on the palatial yacht Christina on the Mediterranean Sea, while passengers such as the Churchills could have shuffled past. But no, such is artistic license, and she gets away with it. You can't help but be sorry for the hapless husband, Tito Meneghini, who comes across as a money-mad sexless cuckold, or dislike the mother who is really no more than an extra nasty bit player who exerted too much influence and thus influenced Maria's own feelings of self-worth. Tina Onassis? She gave as good as she got, so no empathy there. Maria was not a poor little rich girl. She paid her own way, and she paid a heavy price. I don't know about you, but I don't want the life of the rich and famous. But lines like this do somehow make such a life less unappetizing. For breakfast, there was caviar and silky scrambled eggs. For lunch, emeralds and rubies from Cartier. My final 10 cents worth. La Traviata might be the fallen woman, but while not fallen in the biblical sense, she is fallen certainly in the sense of loss. And Maria is really La Tragica. I wish I'd been around to have been at her Tosca at the Royal Opera House. FMR.